greetings and welcome, concerned citizens. We are glad to have you here. Always a pleasure. This is the show where we try to figure out how we ended up on the slippery slope and, of course, what to do to get off it. I'm Henrik, and this is Red Eyes Radio, an independent, alt-right, politically incorrect program that touch on the subjects that we think should be of concern to all Europeans worldwide, at least if they knew the truth about our leaders, their views, and resentment of us. The interests of the Western world is our primary concern, because the Western world is under attack, and if we don't do anything about it, no one will, and it will be lost forever. We invite guests for conversations where we can talk about the many problems we face and what to do to get on the right track once again. We do not always agree with all our guests, but we believe it's important to hear more about the material that our governments and corporate media suppress, forbid, never touch, and outright ban. RedIceCreations.com is the website if you want more. Well, today we're speaking with Tan Staffel. He's behind the blog Age of Treason, which he started in 2005. He describes himself as a white racialist blogger and podcaster with a general interest in science, history, psychology, language, and a specific focus on Jewish influence. We're going to begin to speak about what he sees as enemy number one to the interests of the European people. Later in the program, we're also going to talk about human origins and also the origins of the European people, a subject I've always been very interested in. However, these days, it's a field that has been infested with a lot of propaganda and outright scientific lies as well. We'll spend some time to debunk the melting pot theory, among others, that is, of course, meant to end people's appreciation for their distinct racial differences in an effort to further destroy human biodiversity. But that's more in the second hour. But before we begin, I also just want to reiterate a recent example to you that demonstrates the hypocrisy and double standards of what we'll be discussing more of here today. Just about 2 days ago, before this show was recorded, we had a talk. A talk was done by a government official in Sweden telling us that no native Swedish culture exists. Well, this lady, Ingrid Lundfors, is Jewish. She was educated at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and the Hebrew College in Boston. She is the general secretary at the Jewish community in Stockholm, and she's married to the guy that's heading up the Jewish synagogue in Gothenburg. And currently she's also at the top of the Forum for Living History in Sweden. Well, she did a recent talk to the Swedish government and presented a couple of points to them. And one of these points was to say that there's no domestic Swedish culture, that immigration is nothing new, so we should just kind of relax and accept what's happening right now, and also that we're all a consequence of immigration. And therefore, of course, we should accept everything that's happening right now, because it's just natural. See, it happened in the past. So, you know, by that standard, we should also accept, rape and slavery and human sacrifice, right? Because those are also traits of our rich past. Oh, and also, by the way, our king, the king of Sweden, whose family is from France, and his wife, who's Argentinian, they were, of course, naturally applauding and welcoming this lady. So the double standard I want to try to explain to you before we begin is, imagine if we had a Swedish scholar down in Israel who had distinct interest in Swedish history, was educated in Stockholm and in Swedish studies in America, who studied such things as the Great Northern War and how Swedish people were targeted and died during this, or, for example, when Christianity came in and mass slaughtered our people. And then that this person who was fiercely patriotic also was in charge of, the Church of Sweden, or perhaps the also through Foundation of Scandinavia or something like that. That this person went to Israel to preach to them that there isn't such a thing as a distinct native Jewish culture, and that they should, in fact, open their borders, you know, knock down their wall, literally knock down the wall they have there, and to accept their ultimate demographic demise. Well, do you think that Netanyahu would openly applaud this person? Do you think that they would agree with this? Do you think she even would be allowed to do this? Certainly not. There would be an outrage, absolute outrage, you know. But no, this person is, though. It's no problem. In Sweden, she can sit on a top position and receive government money to tell us that we do not have a native culture and to somehow try to break the moral backbone of the Swedish people. It's absolutely unbelievable what some of these people get away with in our countries. Something that would never fly in basically any other country beyond those founded by European people. I'll link to the story so you can check it out for yourself, but it's examples like this and many other similar statements from other people that have come to the surface in the last few years that show the full-on outspoken resentment for our people that should have your blood boiling at this stage. It's unbelievable that they get away with it. And you know, we are not the ones who are doing something immoral for discussing these facts and the agenda of what some people really feel. I mean, if you feel that way, I think that just demonstrates the level of mind control and conditioning that they have managed to subject you to in the media and education and in all these other contexts. So just take your own side for once, will you? Please? And I want you to have this example and many others in the back of your mind as we hear more from our guest here today. So let's begin. Welcome, Tan Staffel. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's great to speak with you. Hope you're doing well.
Yes, I'm doing well. A pleasure to be here, Henry.
Well, thank you. It's really good to have you here. I've been familiar with your work for some time. I stumbled across your website, ageoftreason.com. Don't know how far back, but I've been following it with interest, a lot of good posts, a lot of good different topics that we like to discuss as well. And I really want to talk a little bit more about some of those today. We have a couple of interesting things lined up, not only, of course, about some of the recent events in Europe and the treatment of our people and all these things, but really dive deeper into the origins of the human species as well and the politics, really, of human origins. But before we go there, maybe you can just tell us a little bit about yourself and how ageoftreason.com came about.
Right. I'm mostly a writer online. I've been writing for about 10 years. I've had the blog Age of Treason, started at Blogspot, a free blogging setup, and only in the last 3 years or so have I started podcasting and voicing my opinions verbally. Mostly I'm interested in race, and that led to the Jews, and you know, everything else is encompassed in that. You know, I'm curious about the origins of Europeans, in part in reaction to the fact that we're propagandized that whiteness is a social construct, that race is a social construct, and that it doesn't really exist except in our minds. And I needed to convince myself what the truth was. I needed to search out the truth about that and search out the truth about these Jews, who they are and what they're doing, why they're doing it.
Do you want to tell us a bit more about how you came to those conclusions in terms of finding what some of the major issues are?
Sure. Briefly, it started, like many people do, with the mainstream politics as I identified as a conservative, although I had become pretty much disgusted with the politics early on and dropped out of it. I was curious when I was younger, and I came back to it in middle age as a conservative, concerned about the war in Iraq and 9/11 and all of that. Why is this going on? And I wasn't happy with the standard mainstream explanation, which is that the other side is just crazy. There's two sides, the left and the right, and depending upon which side you want to affiliate yourself with, you point fingers at the other side, and the explanation is that they're just crazy on the other side. And I wasn't happy with that, so I dug deeper, and initially I went into neoconservatism and started reading a lot of neoconservatives. From there I went to counter-jihad, which seemed to me more of a direct analysis of the Muslims, specifically in this 9/11 in Iraq thing and the threat of Islam behind that, and learned a lot about the history of Islam and what Muslims are, what they're about. And then I started to become concerned about immigration, because in my area where I lived in California, in Southern California, it was turning into Mexico, and I wanted to understand that. And that's when I became really disillusioned with neoconservatives and even counter-jihadists, because the neoconservatives are just as bad as the left as when it comes to open borders. They think open borders are just great, and you know, they're anti-racist. And at that point, I was still not racially aware. I still held back from that. But it was a demonstration, I think, sometime in 2007 in Europe somewhere. I think it was in Brussels, where I saw these white men in suits being manhandled by the police because they had been demonstrating against Islam, against the Islamification of Europe. And a light bulb went on in my head that I became, you know, aware that this was a racial thing. This is not about religion, and it's not about the Muslims even. It's about the white race being exterminated. And I very quickly came to the conclusion it's genocide, it's deliberate, it's forced, it's imposed, that this is something that these white men in suits, for instance, were trying to stand up against. And they are being oppressed or punished for doing so by the very authorities who are supposed to be defending our countries and defending our borders, the military. And I know that the military doesn't give itself orders. It comes from the very top. And so it was that was the beginning of the unraveling for me of the mainstream understanding of things. And when I crossed the boundary of the bubble that separates the acceptable discourse from the unacceptable discourse out in the wild blue yonder there, where you talk about things like the Jews and, you know, on beyond the acceptable, politically correct mainstream discourse.
Well, exactly. I think it's always worth mentioning as well that many of the questions here that we'll talk about today and that you dive deep into and whatnot, these are things that just 80, 90 years ago were on the tongues of many prominent Europeans and Americans as well. This is not, it's changed so radically in the last few years, the last 50, 60 years, that we have become disconnected from what our, you know, grandparents and their parents, etc., were openly talking about, thinking about issues of concern, and it's just changed so much, and we're so much removed from that reality that it's very, it can feel, you know, dangerous to many people. It can feel painful. It can feel even scary to go into those areas and discuss it. But the fact is, this is not something which is out of the ordinary, historically speaking, at all, you know?
No. In fact, that's what I discovered as I got deeper into an understanding of race. I realized that 100 years ago was sort of the peak of European understanding and self-consciousness about race. And it was mainly through science that the Europeans of the time were beginning to understand, going back into history, where we came from and who we are, which are the most important questions that any people can ask about themselves. And because that's what you have to understand in order to know where you want to go, what's good for you and how to choose amongst the paths in front of you going forward. You need to understand the past, and you need to have, more than anything else, an understanding of who we is. Who is us when we talk about us? And the distinction between us and the other, them, is a critical distinction. Without that distinction, no people, no group, no animals, no species can survive. It won't go on if it doesn't make a distinction between itself and the other.
Yep, exactly. And today, we'll get into this more later in the program, but you know, the displacement of our people and those who are protesting against it are basically being handcuffed and arrested and, you know, put on straitjackets, mentally speaking, and in some cases even, of course, tried for some of these things. Marie Le Pen recently here is going to be charged for inciting racial hatred and whatnot. But we'll talk more about that later and how absurd it is when you actually begin to speak out about some of the things that actually is happening. And what's even more absurd is that we know the elite's opinions. We know what they're saying. We have their quotes. Some of them have openly talked about these things. And simply then, when you point these things out, you're the problem. But we'll get into that more later. Let's talk a bit about, you know, human origins and the politics of human origins. I mean, as we know, anthropology has been, it's now weaponized, basically. Same with many other studies as well. This didn't used to be the case, but tell us a bit about how they've broken down these questions, in your opinion, how they changed our fundamental understanding up until the 20th century, basically.
Yeah, weaponized is a good word for it. Another word that you often hear is politicized, and usually it's these ideas, ironically, come from the contemporary Jewish-controlled understanding of history and science. Looking back, they'll talk about this period 100 years ago and call it scientific racism. You know, as if it's just these kooky people who had an agenda, who were trying to come up with a scientific explanation for their superiority. And, of course, the superiority is imagined. It's it's a psychoanalytic projection into the past. This is one of the main tools that the Jews have used to break down and take control away from Europeans who 100 years ago, at least in science, dominated. Science was a European creation going back as far as the Greeks, the initial beginnings of it. Aristotle maybe is one of the earliest examples. Logic and science, mathematics, all of those things are very much related, but it's all based upon rationalism and it's based upon objectivism or objectivity, which is a very prominent European mental trait. And this is something that people who aren't used to thinking about race are probably surprised to hear, but mental traits are racial and inherited just as much as physical traits of skin color and hair type and the shape of your skull or face are. These things were all well understood 100 years ago, although I have to point out that scientists at any point in time, especially in trying to understand the past, are working on sketchy information, and even they sometimes lose sight of that, or at least don't tell the public that what their understanding of history is based upon actually a spotty record. There's lots of gaps in the record, and especially when it comes to human origins, it's not really well understood exactly where human beings come from, how exactly we evolved, in what sequence. They found bits and pieces of skeletons going back 2 and 3 million years, and they think that's where it started. And 100 years ago, the view of scientists was even spottier than it is today. We have the benefit of a lot of things today, not just archaeological discoveries, but the linguistic discoveries, and most important is the genetic discoveries, the discovery of DNA to begin with, but then the analysis that's happened in the last decade or two of figuring out the family tree of what must have been related to what by getting genetic samples from various skeletons that have been found and piecing that together with the linguistic evidence. And to make a long story short, the transition was in the past from the science of race that European scientists and philosophers were engaging in 150 to 100 years ago was displaced. It was psychopathologized and demonized and ultimately derailed and displaced by Jewish narrative, to put it in a nutshell. What the Jews do very well is tell stories and seize the control of people's minds. That's one of the reasons they gravitate toward media. They're good storytellers. They're moralizers. They don't have any hesitation to tell other people what to think and how to see things and what is good and what is bad, to literally define the terms in which we see the world. And that's what's so ironic about the mainstream view today. If you go to Wikipedia or you read some of these mainstream accounts of racial, or anthropological studies, discoveries, like the recent one in South Africa, you'll see that they're telling you basically how they do it, that it's about narrative, that it's about who gets to define who we are and where we came from and where we're going.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, let's talk a bit about how the subject was hijacked. I mean, do we need to go to Franz Boas, anthropology? I mean, Kevin MacDonald and others have spoken a lot about this in terms of how they managed to turn things around, but do we need to back up to an earlier date than that?
Well, Boas is the most well-understood, well-known, well-documented case, and there's been many more going forward. Stephen Jay Gould and Ashley Montague and Jonathan Marks. But going backwards, it gets harder and harder to know for sure exactly who was doing what behind the scenes. The farther back into European history, at least recent European history, say the last 500 years or so, the more it looks like Europeans were fully in control of European society and that the Jews were a sort of marginalized fossil people. This is the mainstream historical view of Toynbee and Spengler, that the Jews were just living in their ghettos. They were pitiable people that were filthy and poor and so forth. That overlooks, of course, the Rothschilds and the other wealthy Jews that assimilated and infiltrated into European society and had a hidden influence on European society. And if you look actually for that kind of stuff going back into history, you can find it in 1492 in Spain. You can find it in Cromwell's England after that, after they got kicked out of Spain. You can find it before 1492. In fact, one of the most influential and clear signs that the Jews have been doing what they're doing for millennia is an ancient papyrus from the Roman Empire in 41 AD. The Emperor Claudius wrote an edict in response to a conflict between Alexandrians who in Egypt that were the descendants of the Greeks and Macedonians who came in with Alexander and founded the city. They were still pretty much in control. I don't know what it would be, 500 years later. But there were Jews in the city, and the Jews were struggling for control over that city with them. And it was, as Revelo Oliver describes it, and Revelo Oliver was able to read the Greek, the original ancient Greek of the Claudius's edict directly, because he was a student of antiquity, and he found this papyrus, this fragment, and publicized it in a book called The Jewish Strategy. The Jewish strategy hasn't really changed in all this time. For 2,000 years, this is what the Jews have been doing. They infiltrate a society, they partly assimilate into that society, and manipulate the people and exploit the people amongst whom they live. The mechanism in this case that was highlighted is that the Jews themselves had private institutions that were just for Jews, just like they have today. But at that time, they were trying to argue with the emperor that the Alexandrians had no right to have their own institutions, that they needed, because discrimination, anti-racism is the terms we would put it in today, of tolerance, all of that, the Alexandrians need to just open up their society so that the Jews can join them in their schools, in their right. In the military, in government, and at the same time have their own. So it's a very basic mechanism where if one people is allowed to have to themselves their own private gene pool and their own private schools and some of them are able then to go into the wider society around them, there is no other competing group which is allowed to have any sort of closed private organizations or institutions, well, who do you think is going to win in the long term? And this has been the paradigm or the mechanism by which Jews have operated for at least that long. It probably goes back farther into history. If we knew more about it, but the historic record, the written historic record, only goes back 5,000 years, and by the time you get back there, it's only numbers on a clay tablet about how many bales of wheat were stored somewhere. You know, yeah, so it gets very spotty beyond the Roman Empire and the Greeks. But even with the Greeks, the Jews had their conflict with the Greeks. The Jews had their conflict with the Egyptians before the Romans. The Jews had their conflict with Persia, the Babylonians, the Assyrians. And, you know, the bottom line is that they survived. And all of those other civilizations that they infiltrated, manipulated, and exploited ultimately were destroyed. And you could say, well, maybe it wasn't the Jews, maybe it was something else. But the one common factor in it all is the Jews. Their narrative of history, this is really just an inversion of their telling of the story. They're the ones telling the story about their captivity in Babylon and their exodus from Egypt and their conflict with Greeks and conflicts with Rome. It's just that when they tell the story, it's entirely from their point of view. You know, they were being oppressed for no good reason. It was just these horrible anti-Semites that wanted to keep them out of their society because they were horrible haters. You know, the way you can see that that's just bogus is it amounts to, you know, let me in your country, you horrible racist. It's like what we see today with the Syrians and the Africans who want to come to Europe and, you know, let us in your country, you horrible Nazis. The two things that create this cognitive dissonance because they contradict each other. If they're so horrible, why do they want to live amongst us?
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's true. I mean, this whole topic, just from a historical perspective, is absolutely fascinating and should be discussed more. But the explanation that we get today, even if it's brought up, just as you say, is really attributed to some kind of almost supernatural, irrational hatred that the Europeans had that has no basis in reality whatsoever. And it's kind of, I mean, at what point, when you look at history, do you begin to question the other party here that's constantly being kicked out? I mean, people have counted and counted, but there's just hundreds and hundreds of places from the I think he had a map from the about 800 up to the to 1100 or something like that. Oh, wait a minute, it extended a little bit more. I'm forgetting exactly what time frame it was, but anyway, it was a map of Europe that dotted all the expulsions and things like this. And looking at this map, I just like, my God, this is just what is this? I mean, this is incredible. Yeah. What is it in the behavior that has spawned this type of you know, resentment then for the behavior? And the very lack of self-reflection here is, I think, another problem in the equation, that there's just simply no recognition that whatever they do, they have a free pass to do anything all the time. And if you begin to question this, if you have a problem with this, you're the ones who's the hater. You know, just get out of the way and let us do whatever we want to do to you, right?
It's a measure of the strength of their racial consciousness, the strength of their ethnocentrism, is that they are so confident that they are right in every situation that it doesn't even occur to them to think objectively of, well, you know, maybe these people that are complaining about the Jews have a point. You know, there have been a handful of Jews that have written books about that with that kind of an attitude, but they're usually shouted down by the bulk of Jewry as self-hating Jews. You shouldn't think that way. And that's partly how it's enforced. And Kevin MacDonald has written quite a lot about that, and he was definitely one of the major stepping stones to where I am now as far as understanding the history of this and how the mechanics work of it. What it comes down to is, you were talking about expulsions. That's just in the recent 2,000 years of recent European history, what we normally think of as Europe as you know, the post-Roman order. And there are hundreds of expulsions there from each of the individual nations of Europe all around, from one end to the other. But as I just mentioned before that, it goes back into antiquity, into the dimmest part where history is lost. We don't even know what happened. And this is according to the Jews themselves, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, all of these ancient civilizations, which all we have now is dusty ruins, remains of, to infer what happened, and the Jews' tales of it. It's the way to understand it is to invert what the Jewish telling of it. The Jewish telling is an excuse. They're making excuses for themselves why they're still here, and all of the other societies in which they resided outside of Europe, before Europe, or before Europe came to be called Europe, those things are all gone now. And when I say you invert the Jewish telling of it, well, their telling, the flip side of that, or the other way to understand it, is their telling is an inversion of reality. And it continues to this day where we see them inverting the reality of what's happening. When they're bombing Palestinians,
yes, exactly.
Then a bunch of Jews get on their soapboxes here in the American media to talk about how Jews are being criticized by horrible anti-Semites, and Jews are actually the victims in all of this. Anticipating, nobody actually really got up on any media soapbox, any mainstream media soapbox, to criticize the Jews for it. It was just Jews anticipating how they were going to be criticized for it and wringing their hands and talking about what victims they were.
Is that the framework you think people should have? I mean, think about Israel's actions in Palestine. I mean, is that indicative in itself as a representation of the behavior? Because many people can look at that today and see how incredibly out of line they are, you know?
Yeah, the way to understand it is they are absolutely ruthless when it comes to their interests and defending their interests. They will bomb unarmed civilians in Israel, and they will lie flat out on the other side of the planet to explain what's going on back in Israel while they're busy infiltrating the government of on the other side of the planet in order to redirect resources back to Israel in the form of either weapons or money. It's parasitism. That's how to understand what they do, and everything that they do. The crypsis, the, you know, pretending not to be Jews some of the time, and others wearing it on their sleeves, and the boldness, chutzpah, that the arrogance with which they tell other people how to organize their lives in order basically to suit Jewish needs and Jewish sensibilities. You have to outlaw hate speech because Jews, basically. You have to open your borders. Why? because Jews. That's, I mean, they usually, they're clever enough to use some sort of an excuse, some sort of cover story for it. But when it comes down to it, when you strip away the nonsense cover story or invert the logic of it, invert, you know, so it matches reality and you understand what's really happening, you can see it's just because Jews. And it's Jews driving this narrative and driving the direction. The Romans had an ancient expression for this, cui bono, who benefits. You know, that's one way to tell when a crime is committed, you know, who, it's one indication of who committed the crime is who benefits from this crime being committed. And I think we've got a lot more than just cui bono in this case of the invasion of Europe and, mm-hmm. and the collapse of Western civilization. It's, yeah. There's a group of people who have been telling Europeans how awful and horrible and evil they are for centuries now, out loud, infiltrating Western universities, pretending to be us, and telling us how horrible we are. And yeah. You can see examples of that every day in the online media. You can find a story where there's some Jew who says, as a white person, you know, I'm against white privilege. I'm against white supremacism. I'm, you know, the horrible things the white race has done. And it's just over and over and over. It's like the Chinese water torture, just drip, drip, drip every day in the ears of white people who think these are, you know, moral white people, fellow white people that see something that they don't. And so they, you know, we're generally conformists. Most human beings are herd animals to a certain extent domesticated. And so we follow who we think is offering a narrative, an authoritative narrative. And that's one of the benefits that the Jews have in controlling the corporate media, is that it sounds authoritative. It's coming from a very polished source on high, you know, broadcast and with the approval of the government. And, you know, what most people don't understand is white people lost control of our media 100 years ago or so, and certainly by the 1960s.
Exactly. And you can even feel, I can anyway, that this is somehow something you should be afraid of even talking about. That, and this is indicative of the fact of how deep the programming goes and how deeply that as a psychological mechanism is, that somewhere I've been just programmed with this that I'm not allowed to speak about. I mean, if these were Muslims doing this to us, I would talk about it. If this was Norwegians subverting our societies, I would be talking about it. In that regard, it's not about that. It's about addressing the reality of the proof that we can find in front of our faces that this is what's happening. And you can see that there's as you say, a ruthless ethnic self-interest here that's driving this. But somehow, despite that, you feel that you're not like quite you know, in a safe spot just discussing these realities. You know,
right? It's very real, the fear and the psychological part of this. There may be an inborn tendency amongst Europeans to be more universalist, objective, to step outside ourselves and see the bigger picture from an objective point of view as a conflict of interest. Even I think that's one of our tendencies. It's a strength and a weakness. It's what enabled us to create science, but it makes us manipulatable by these charlatans who come and play word games on us and play moral games on us. And that's the technique that the Jews have used. And this taboo, you know, a good indication that it is mostly mental is the fact that people talk about waking up. They talk about how they realized at some point it was like a rubber band snapping in their head, and they realize that they've been defrauded, they've been lied to. And once they realize that, then they resent the source of that lie, the source of that fraud, as they rightly should. And that's to our advantage, I think. It's also an indication that this is not, while the tendency may be burned into our genes, we are not fatally stupid. We're not right. So stupid that it's nothing we can do about it because it's burned into our genes. We're here talking about it, you and I. Many other people have talked about this waking up process. And as far as the taboo goes, it is the deepest taboo. When I first understood race, very shortly afterwards, I came to understand the Jewish role, or at least began to understand that the Jews were not the paragons of virtue and morality that they portray themselves as. And that's why there is a taboo there, is because they present themselves as these people who could not possibly have any sort of bad intention. They are just, what's their saying, tikkun olam, fixing the world, you know, bringing the light to the world. This is their own self-narrative of themselves. They have the narrative of anti-Semitism, that it comes out of nowhere, it's just the evil people around them. And that sort of black and white view of the world, of us versus them, and the them is rotten and evil and stupid and crazy, that's actually pretty normal, that every group has that kind of tendency, that kind of instinct. But the Jews just have it to a degree that is beyond most white people's even ability to imagine it. And that's why we are basically at a big disadvantage when we finally do wake up in our middle age or later early adulthood to what's going on. We are way behind in the game. And even though there may be more of us, we're the ones who are awake and conscious, there's less of us than there are of Jews, because almost every Jew, if they are a good Jew, is aware of their Jewish history, and they're aware of this black and white attitude that I'm talking about, that they're basically behind enemy lines. You and I, and you know, I think about this a lot myself, is in my current situation, I'm like behind enemy lines, because the enemy runs my government. My government is actually against my interests, operating against me.
Yeah.
But the Jews are born that way, and if they're whatever isn't inborn is taught to them in the early schooling that they get from their own people. They're taught this narrative of, even though they may control all the politicians, and that's only for now, you know, they all keep a suitcase under the bed just in case the goyim wake up, as has happened many, many times in the past in history.
Exactly. And of course, now they have Israel. And there's a couple more things I want to mention. I want to switch over to human origins here as well. We can definitely return to this later. It's an interesting question. But I wanted to mention as well, I mean, this overall as a topic, it's not something that I want to address all the time. It's not some kind of obsession for the sake of it, as I'm sure some would accuse me of at this stage, because we have guests that simply, you know, that we bring on the program, and we have a number of things lined up that we want to talk about, and then when we end up talking about the controllers, this is where we end up, because it's simply based on the empirical reality. We're finding proof of these things. If I were finding an equal amount of proof that this was, you know, the Vatican and the Jesuits behind it, I'd gladly go there, you know, but I haven't been able to find as much evidence for that. I mean, this is simply holding true to the tenet of letting the answers lead the way primarily, and letting us just examine all these questions to try to sort out, is there something to this? What's the evidence for this? What is the consequences of you know, finding these things out, etc. So it's just like it's just the topic that's there, ladies and gentlemen. But let me mention one more thing, and then we can switch over. I want to give this as an example, actually, to what we just were talking about. Let me read you a headline here: Jewish official warns Iceland of negative repercussions over Reykjavik boycott of Israel. And the first paragraph goes on: Ronald Lauder, the billionaire philanthropist, heir to the S.D. Lauder Cosmetics fortune and the president of the World Jewish Congress, angrily denounced the government of Iceland on Friday for failing to mount opposition to the Reykjavik City Council's decision to boycott Israeli products. I mean, that's really what we're talking about here, too, of making threats against countries for making political decisions over and basically following through of what they are considering to be you know, moral acts and whatever. And there's many times that these kinds of threats have been made to nations. And then, strangely, afterwards, we've had these, you know, false flags appearing in these countries and terrorist, you know, bombs and whatnot. I mean, I'm saying this because, like, Iceland, watch your back. You know, you're going to get Mossad agents in there, and they're going to set something on fire, you know?
Yes, that's the fear that people have of criticizing the Jews, the taboo, is not just words. It's not just irrational and there's no substance to it. There is very real substance to it. The Jews will punish you financially at first, or verbally at first, and then financially, and then ultimately, you know, wet works. They'll send in Mossad if you're that much of a thorn in their side. So it's the psychological attack is sort of a hallmark of how the Jews do things. This, I call it psychopathologizing, demonizing. Those are just the fancy word, academic words for calling their enemies stupid and crazy. And especially intelligent white people don't want to be called stupid. They don't want to be thought of by their peers as stupid or crazy. And so we are afraid that the attack is, you know, you're obsessed with the Jews. The minute you mention even Jew once, the minute it seems like you're even entertaining going there, you're immediately challenged, even by other white people who are afraid to associate with you. They might be just commenters on your blog, and they don't want to talk about Jews themselves, and they don't want to be accused and attacked. And so they have learned, you know, one of the primary mechanisms by which they convince you not to talk about the Jews is to accuse you of being stupid or crazy. Obsessed is just another word for that. You know, you're obsessed with the Jews. The thing about that is there's no way you could be more obsessed about the Jews than the Jews themselves are. It's not possible. And even though I've, you know, as a hobby or on the side, have made a, it's not for pay, for a living, I do computer programming. But in my spare time, I've tried to understand and teach myself about race and about the Jews. As knowledgeable as I am about the Jews, more than 99.9% of the other white people out there, I still probably have like a third grade Jew understanding of the Jews and their history and their mindset. It goes so deep. And yet at the same time, I don't want to discourage people from talking or thinking about race and the Jews just because there is so much detail there. The basics are pretty simple and elementary and necessary to understand. It's not this big complicated topic and that you should be scared away from ever mentioning just because you don't understand every detail of it. That's the other way that they intimidate away intelligent people who are used to focusing on a particular topic. Before they can speak authoritatively on it, they have to have a degree in it or something like that. That keeps a lot of people from ever thinking about the Jews as well, because they think, well, I don't really understand it, and it's a deep topic, and I don't have time for that. I've got other things to worry about. Well, I take it from someone like me who has dedicated now hundreds, thousands of hours to try and understand it, that, yes, it goes very deep, and it goes way back in history, as far back as you want to go, but the basics are simple and easy to understand. They're elementary. And one of the points is, a very simple one I see on a daily basis, is people around me will make disparaging comments about this group or that group. Oh, the Germans, they've got to be crazy to be letting all these immigrants in. First of all, talking about the Germans as if they're a collective, and second of all, saying something very negative about them, that they're all crazy, they're all stupid. Well, that's the thing with the Jews. The minute you talk about the Jews collectively and say something negative about them, it's like red bells start going off in people's heads. You can't do that.
Yeah, exactly.
And these are the very same people who were just, you know, talking badly about Germans or talking badly about Christians or talking badly about whatever other imaginary group that is just as ill-defined or more ill-defined than the Jews are. But that's okay. And white people, you know, white people don't really exist, but we can blame them for this and that bad thing.
Absolutely.
Throughout history.
You know,
that disparity, that asymmetry is one of the ways you can sort of climb out of the hole to realize that this is not kosher. This doesn't make logical sense, what the way people are behaving about these things. It's not objective. It sets off the warning bells in a European's objective tendency mind to step above the fray and understand things. Hey, wait a minute. White people are being treated to a totally different standard than Jews are, and yet Jews are supposedly white. How does that make sense? How do you?
It's true. Well, let me just play that. I mean, I got to play that clip.
Yours is a voice of criticism we don't often hear in the United States. Often when there is dissent expressed in the United States against policies of the Israeli government, people here are called anti-Semitic. What is your response to that as an Israeli Jew?
Well, it's a trick. We always use it. When from Europe somebody is criticizing Israel, then we bring up the Holocaust. When in this country people are criticizing Israel, then they are anti-Semitic. And the organization is strong and has a lot of money, and the ties between Israel and the American Jewish establishment are very strong, and they are strong in this country, as you know. They have power, which it's okay. They are talented people, and they have power, money, and media, and other things. And their attitude is Israel, my country, right or wrong.
Anyway, it goes on from there. But yeah, you, I'm sure you've heard that. I mean, it's a classic.
Yes.
The rhetoric is a little bit different there. But nonetheless, that's basically what she's saying there. She's an Israeli minister, Shalumit Aluni, if I pronounce her name correct. And that's really what it's about, that there are always these various kind of, you know, cards that are played to automatically shut people down. It's like, well, what about the Holocaust? Or, you know, you're not a Nazi, are you? You know, those kinds of things are thrown out immediately.
Right. The basic trick that she's alluding to there is to call people paranoid, that they think that there's any sort of wrong being done by the Jews. And the reality is that it is just a trick. The Jews are thinking, and this is their strength, they are thinking constantly of what's best for the Jews. And they disagree even with each other. They point fingers at each other and call each other anti-Semites or Jew, self-hating Jews. And it's because they are ultimately obsessed with that basic question is, who is the better Jew and what's best for Jews? You know, it's that simple.
Yep. Now, let me ask you a bit more. We can switch over here a little bit and talk more about human origins and that question a bit here. And just talk about the aspect that what we've been taught is that everything we're getting lately is science, right? This is proof. It's irrefutable. It shows that we are all the same. And the very aspect that when you begin to bring up differences, there's this whole wall of nonsense, frankly, that you come up against with, you know, links to Discovery and Times Magazine and National Geographic and everything else that are ultimately proving that whatever you're talking about, you're absolutely, wrong. So as soon as you go into human origins, it really has become politicized that if you're trying to show that there are some kind of differences between us, you're immediately shot down, right?
Right. It's a struggle. It's part of the culture war, you could say, between whites and Jews, basically. As I said earlier, it's white objectivity, science, versus Jewish moralizing and narrative, storytelling. And the Jews are on top now and have been for 100 years, since Boaz's day. And that shift was from the physical anthropologists, scientists studying race and looking at the archaeological record, back then to today, we have what's called cultural anthropology, which is all about narrative and telling stories and the equivalence of various cultures, and that there is no real biological race, and that's all mixed in with. I don't want to misrepresent it. It's not like the war is over. There is still a struggle going on. There are still white scientists. They don't think of themselves as racialists or as advocates for their people. They're just doing what it comes instinctively to them. They're trying to empirically understand objectively what happened in the past. How did we get here? And so they're digging up bones and they're trying to figure it out as best they can, as accurately as they can. But they operate under a big handicap. They can't connect in any way their work to what was being done 100 years ago, because that's all, tainted now as being anti-Jewish and racist. And so they come up with different words for what they're doing. They, instead of calling it race, they call it population genetics. Instead of calling it race science, they have changed the words. They literally use euphemisms. Instead of calling them Aryans, they call them Indo-Europeans. it's a tremendous handicap. In politics today, they have this thing called dog whistling, right? And this is the idea that Republican right-wing, far-right politicians must speak in code to their white voters, their white base, in order to make their promises that they're going to fulfill their racist desires. That's what the left calls dog whistling. And they talk about it as if it's some indication of rotten intent. It's really a projection of their own technique, their own speaking in code that they do. But the main point is that the fact that the right has to do that to their voters and speak in code, speak in whispers, is a big disadvantage, that you can't just speak plainly. as the other, the non-white groups can, about their interests, and that they, when a non-white politician goes to office, they are there to bring home the bacon for their people,
yes,
their constituency.
Exactly.
And it's out in the open. They make promises to their people that are explicit, and then they deliver, or they try as hard as they can to deliver.
Look at the, I mean, there's more talk on the Republican side about, we're going to win the Latino vote, we're going to win the black vote. It's
yes.
Like, well, what about the white people? They're still a majority in this in America.
Yes, if it was about votes, they would be going for the white demographic.
Yeah, because it's like, still, we don't even care about them anymore, right?
Yeah, well, because it's not really about votes. It's more about the financial support and media support that you can get from the Jewish demographic. And that's why the Jews are so important to politics. It's not because of their votes. It's because of their money and their control over media. But as far as human origins goes, and this struggle is still going on today, there are certain anthropologists which are trying to do an objective scientific job of it, and then there are these cultural anthropologists. Jonathan Marks, I mentioned, he's mentioned in this recent story about the discovery in South Africa, who are trying to basically spin it. And
yeah,
we saw it in the Kostenki 14 discovery that was came out a year, a bit more ago, where they did some genetic sequencing on an ancient skeleton and discovered that even as far as 40,000 years ago, Europeans were pretty much what we are today and genetically homogenous over a vast area of what we would think of not just as Europe today, but out into the boundaries around Europe. And yet at the same time that they're writing these stories describing the bare facts like that you have to sort of read between the lines to put those kind of things together. They're spinning a race mixing melting pot. we got to mix it up because just like our ancestors did, it's taking the facts, which is that we Europeans are an amalgam of several other groups that were in fact pretty closely related to each other, even though they're identifiably separate, distinctive genetically. They and one group flooded into Europe. The Aryans conquered Europe, and the Middle Eastern farmers moved into Europe and displaced the hunter-gatherers that were already there and melded with them too. All three of these groups were all very closely related genetically to begin with. And the lesson I take away from that is even when you have very closely related groups, that there can be racial animosity between them and conquest and warfare. And so to import Africans into Europe, to import Asians into Europe who were 100,000 and 40,000 years removed from genetically, that is just insanity. It's just a literal insanity of you've got to be crazy to think that that's going to work, that there isn't going to be even more difficult problems to deal with because of that.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels like societies have fallen in the past, great ones, lesser ones, what have you, but when they enter into the multicultural tract, either if they're encouraged by it or pushed into it, or if it's through, some kind of importing tons of slaves that are doing a lot of work or whatever, and then eventually they become citizens and things are turned around, and eventually that civilization, that society, seems just to collapse, basically.
Yeah, from my understanding of history, a little bit that I've done, amateur level history, is that's exactly it. The tendency toward empire, and the collapse then ultimately of the empire because it is overwhelmed by diversity. The diversity is divisive, and in the end, the empire collapses because of that. Whatever the founding stock is, it eventually becomes so diluted and loses control. And that's what happened in Rome. That's probably what happened in Babylon, Persia, all the rest
Egypt,
of them as well.
Maybe even too. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And from what we know of the record, the tattered bits and pieces, that seems to fit that understanding. And even I think it's racial differences of Europeans. The book is The Inequality of Human Races by Arthur Gobineau, published in about 1850, when the white race was pretty much at its peak as far as controlling supposedly 9/10 of the surface of the globe, either directly in Europe or North America and Australia, or having colonized most of the rest of the world, including China and India and Africa. And Gobineau was writing at that time, and his thesis of his book was that this was just sort of the latest cycle of the rise and fall of civilizations. I think Spengler had a similar idea a little bit later, maybe refined it a bit. And that his Gobineau's thesis was based on race, and it had to do with race mixing, that the initial success was due to some group, some clan, that struck upon some new and innovative technique by which they were able to gain power, and from there they spread out, conquered their neighbors, and this is basically the pattern of empire, that ultimately they conquered so far that they became just a ruling minority over a much larger group of people, and became eventually mixed with those people, and then their empire would collapse and it would start again. This was the pattern that he discerned in his understanding of history back 150 years ago or so. And we see it today with the American empire. It's just the latest.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's over for America. I just don't see any hope for it.
I hope it's over for America. It's become a poisonous influence, and it's killing not just the American core, the founding stock of America has already been displaced and removed from power mostly, but it's threatening now Europe, the fatherland, the motherland of European peoples.
It plagues me more than anything else. It's horrible to think about this. Let me just ask about something else here for a moment. And what do you see as the origin? Because when we talk about these things, one thing that occurs to me is obviously, are we wrecking something which we are never ever going to be able to get back? That's the big question. I mean, there's plenty of people still in Europe. It's a majority European. It's really just about changing the mind. It's, in that sense, a metapolitical battle that influences culture, that brings people back to their roots and their origins and a sense of pride again in who they are. And voila, there you go, because then people won't, you know, potentially blend themselves out as the elite wishes that we would do. But it's really about a point of origin here, that if you do you think that we come from, you know, different origin points, or is there a common trait somewhere far back in history? Because ultimately the question is, if this was, you know, destroyed, if you will, if this was eradicated, is there a possibility that this would come back through refinement, or would it forever be lost, if you see what I'm saying?
Yes, with genetic engineering and our knowledge of genetics now, it is possible actually to, and this is kind of a nightmare of the Jews, and actually something that they've taken control over and will be the ones to implement if anybody can, is to be able to select what you consider the ideal and then to make that happen. The technology exists now to do that. Through eugenics was an early recognition of this, but it was much softer than what I'm saying is possible now with technology and cloning. Even, I mean, you could take what you consider to be the epitome that you want to come to be dominant and filter out. You could even, with the technology that exists now, it's not hard to imagine bioweapons that are genetically targeted, so that if there's a particular group of people that you want to save or you want to attack, that you can target a biological weapon to do so. I think that if the technology doesn't already exist, it will exist very soon.
I remember a story many years ago about Israel was trying to develop some kind of, you know, bomb or whatever, like biomedical things that would actually target Palestinians. You know, so they've been looking
the
into this for a
while. The problem that they have there is that they're closely genetically related.
Exactly, that's what happened. They would target themselves, basically. Yeah.
And there's speculation that HIV, AIDS, was developed in a weapons lab, and it's just not. It's science fiction-y, but it's also we're on the cusp of actually the human race, the intelligent portion of it that is doing science in this area is on the verge of discovering it if it hasn't already been developed. Now, as far as the origins, going way back into history, it's kind of dim, you know, these bioweapons aside, you know, physical deliberate manipulation aside, the historic record shows this kind of invasion and conquest all the way back, and the mixing that comes from it, the consequences of it are pretty much not able to be undone. They work themselves out in some way over time. But the Slavic incursion into Europe is a good example of this that has happened over, who knows, the last 1,000 years or so. Balkans, the basket case of the Balkans is another good example of, where peoples have just, it's been a crossroads of warfare and conquest and ethnic rivalry. It's almost like a mirror of the Middle East in Europe, in the Balkans. And that's the future for all of Europe. Now, the northwestern part of Europe has been, up until recently, genetically and indirectly culturally, because culture springs from the genetics, genetically homogenous, remarkably homogenous, going back 40,000 years to this Kostenki 14 sample that they found. And the Cro-Magnon man is another example of this that lived from about 45,000 years ago to about 25,000 years ago. Samples that are remarkably homogenous have been found from one tip of modern-day Europe to the other, and these people were pretty much all the same. And they were ultimately replaced by these other combinations, the hunter-gatherers and the Aryans and the Middle Eastern farmers, the three main components of modern European man. But the thing that you won't read in most accounts of this, and certainly won't read it in Wikipedia, is that those three main components were all just basically descendants of one common ancestor, which what we call Cro-Magnon man has, and there's a new euphemism for Cro-Magnon now that is part of this. You know, it's sort of like how blacks, African Americans today, you know, they used to be called Negroes, and then they were called blacks, and then they were called African Americans, and you know, there's this politically correct shift in language.
On that side.
Well, it's same in science. If a word becomes too useful to white people, it's got to go. We're not allowed to keep using it.
Yeah.
You know, and that changing of words is an indication of the power that the Jewish media has, and Jewish academia, over our brains, and that they can force us to use different words. And I liked your last guest, your recent guest, Daniel, that he was talking about metapolitics. And part of that is, I haven't read his book, but I can understand what he's getting at, is language is a very important part of asserting our own identity and our own interests, is to think for ourselves and in our own terms.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I mean, think about it too. I mean, we've already lost so many, many tribes not only Europe, all over the world, but, you know, we're talking about Europe here primarily. And, you know, you can look at an old, you know, Roman map with the different namings and just see a multitude of these different peoples that have slowly been absorbed into others and you know, conquered and taken over and absorbed into a greater empire, et cetera, et cetera. And although the differences might have been, you know, very slight between some of them had distinct different languages, distinct different cultural traits and the type of patterns that they had on their, shields and garments and, you know, just these, a wonderful diversity, basically. And it's just been one long road towards eradicating differences, towards centralization, towards greater and greater empires. And many of these groups have just completely been, destroyed, annihilated by if it was the Roman Empire, for example, or other tribes. And that alone, I mean, it's like should be a warning to us today of saying that, wait a minute, isn't it time to preserve the human biodiversity that we have now, that we can't change the past, but at least let's not continue on that path and eradicate them even more. But that's what's happening, and it plagues me like nothing else, you know?
Yeah, the irony is that the drive to diversity is actually homogenizing and destroying real diversity. But there is a dangerous side there too, as well, that the celebration of European differences, the recognition of the different cultural traits and linguistic deviations and so forth, where we get to be too proud of that, and then we have these cousin wars where our minor differences are sort of inflated by Jews and others who are trying to manipulate us for their own benefit, to cause us to come into conflict with each other and fight terrible wars that profit from, then moving into the space, the vacuum left behind after the war is over, or selling us arms during the war. And it's happening again in Ukraine right now.
Exactly.
Where basically Europeans are fighting Europeans for fighting over that part of that extremity of Europe, while meanwhile the core of Europe is being invaded by complete aliens.
Yeah, I know. It's true. Well, let's kind of pick this up after the break and just basically press the pause button here and continue the conversation afterwards. It's very interesting. We have much more to get into. And there's a lot of different, you know, tangential things that is related to this that I want to bring up as well. But before we do that, let's just talk about your website a little bit. Tell us about what you have available there. Do you have any plans on books or other kinds of publications in the future or something like that?
I thought for a long time about writing a book to sort of sum up what I've learned so far. I don't know. I think the world has enough books.
There's a lot of books out there, but, you know.
but that's a possibility someday. For now, you know, I try to, I've got both writings and going all the way back to the beginning of my blog, and so it may seem a bit incoherent. If you start at the very beginning, you find this neocon-minded man and still not even racially aware, and it's not until 2007 that I developed some sort of racial understanding. And then from that point on, what I tried to do was delve into all of the different areas that I was confused about and that I thought I needed to understand better, and wrote an article to sort of take along whoever was following. It was like an open diary as to where my research was going, and started podcasting relatively late, but now there's a body of podcasts to listen to too. Recently, I'm not doing very much. I'm not writing or talking very much because I'm, frankly, I've said it all. Now I'm just repeating myself, plugging. I see what's happening in the current events, and I plug it back into something that I've written about in the past. It sounds, when I do something, it sounds like I'm self-promoting or something, except I'm not selling anything. I'm not trying to sell a book. I'm not trying to fund my family by doing this kind of work. So, you know, I don't want to get into a, and I don't have time. I'm more nowadays doing more with my profession, doing my work. I don't really have the inclination to do it anymore, but I don't want to say that I'm never going to do it again. I have this body of understanding and knowledge that I, you know, who knows, when the mood strikes me again, I may start doing something. Part of the problem is that I'm not leadership material. I'm psychologically, I'm not, but also I've married a woman who's half Jewish, and it makes me, in my own opinion, I have to recuse myself from any sort of authority or position of leadership of white people. I have no moral standing to lead white people. That's the first thing that occurs to most people who kind of wake up and understand what's going on. They want to fight, and they see nobody else is ready to fight, so they want to lead. They want to,
right,
you know, teach people,
yeah,
we've got to fight, I'll follow me, I'll lead. And that instinct is there with me, too. I'm a white man. I want to fight, but I have no moral standing to tell white people, hey, follow me, the guy with the half-Jewish woman again in our fight against our enemy, the Jews. That is the reality. It's a sort of tragedy. It's my personal tragedy of who I am, and I can't do anything about. But that doesn't hold me back from saying what I think the truth is, that the Jews are the enemy, and they've been the our age-old enemy.
Well, is your wife not a good woman?
She is a good woman.
Yeah.
And that's why I stay with her, and that's she supports what I do. She's half white, after all. She's not. She doesn't identify as a Jew.
Right.
But still, it's a chink in my armor. It's a weakness. It's a fatal flaw, really, in who I am, that prevents me from being a leader. I mean, what's the first thing that they do when they want to tear down Hitler? Is they talk about, oh, Hitler was really a Jew, you know, his grandfather or something,
right,
or anybody. And you know what? There's a basis of truth to it. The fact is that. That is how the Jews have influenced and better manipulate our society, is by partly intermarrying with not just Europeans, but any society that they try to infiltrate and manipulate. They intermarry. That's part of an integral part of what they do. And there does seem to be something magical, almost. I'm sure there's a scientific basis to it, but a sort of dominance to their genes, whereby even a partial, even one grandparent, is enough to give that quarter Jew a sense of Jewishness and a sense of loyalty to the tribe over the other three quarters of who they are biologically.
Yeah, isn't that, I mean, that's indicative in Hollywood, of course, when it's found out, it's like, oh my God, I'm Jewish, you know, it's like...
yeah, so the point where even white people will imagine that they're part Jewish.
Well, they wish they were. This is the point here, that it's such a promotion of that culture, and it's also a kind of like that there is a... They have something that we Europeans don't, a tradition and a culture kind of thing. You know what I mean? They have a religious tradition, and it's just so beautiful, and we really don't have that. And I'm serious. I mean, that's really seems to be the dialogue that's ongoing there, which is blatant lies and just absurd to talk about that. But it really shows that aspect that it's the culture has been promoted so much through Hollywood that people wish that they was part of it in that way, you know?
It's a measure of their dominance that they attract people that want to convert, that want to be Jews. And at the same time, if you investigate Jewish identity and what the Jews are, they are very exclusive. They don't really want converts. Not only do they not proselytize, they actively push people away because they themselves recognize the biological basis of their peoplehood, that it's a biological thing. It's not a religion that's purely in the mind. The religious aspect of Judaism is just a religious racism, really, a religious level of racial consciousness.
Do you think that there are, like, rabbis keeping records when there are, like, these chiksas are marrying some Jews in Hollywood, and then they convert, and they, you know, know who's not pure, whatever?
Yeah, they not only do they have a very long memory going back of historic events, but they have an obsessive need to document family history and who married who, and to know about any goyim in the woodpile there. And they look down upon it and they try to expunge it. You know, it's necessary for their survival that some of them go off and, you know, take one for the team by intermarrying with the goyim. But ultimately, at the core, they don't want any of those genes entering their gene pool. And it's basically like a it's not a hard and fast thing. They can't sell it they can't make it a hard and fast thing outside of Israel where they control things. But there's a tendency, a push, a force outward from their core out, so that once one Jew intermarries with a non-Jew, that the kids tend to go even further out and intermarry and so on and so forth. But they don't. It's a remarkable retention of Jewish identity, that even when they get very diluted, that they still have an awareness of their Jewishness and a loyalty to their Jewishness that overrides whatever else they might be. And that too is part of the parasitic nature of that group of people, that they have this ability to invade the host around them, and that even the parts that become part of the host tend to serve the interests of the core of their organism.
Age of Treason, that's the website. Let me give you the URL here. age-of-treason, or hyphen, I guess it's age-of-treason.com. That's the website that we are talking about. Check out some of the material there in the podcast. We'll, of course, have a link up on ours. And, we'll take a short break right here. Ladies and gentlemen, stay with us. Stay with us, Tan Staffel, and we'll be right back with more. Thank you. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to continue as we do in the second hour with more of Tan Staffel to talk more about European origins and human origins in general, and also debunk some of the melting pot theories that has nestled its way into the sciences. So much more is coming up. Please don't miss the second hour. You can sign up at redicemembers.com to hear the rest, and of course all our other programs in their entirety. Over 1,000 shows on a lot of different topics, so do please check it out. All right, well, we'll take a short break here, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much again for listening. We'll talk to you right after the break. See you on the other side.